Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show.
Hi, this is Dr. John, and I am thrilled to announce that Jory and I are opening up our retreat in beautiful Costa Rica from September 28th of 2024 to October 5th. Everyone wants fulfilling relationships. The hard part is love is not enough. So many factors can get in the way, preventing ongoing connection, intimacy, and aligned growth. All healthy relationships start within. But when we have unresolved stuff, it can easily interfere with those we are seeking to be closest with. Whether you're in a long-term committed partnership or are single and are looking for love, this retreat will guide you in the heroic journey of healing yourself so that you can be open and available to cultivate the fulfilling relationships you desire and deserve. To find out more, visit jorierose.com/retreats. That's jorierose.com/retreats. Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John back with yet another episode of the Evolved Caveman Podcast. And it is my extreme pleasure to have back on the show Dr. Pillay Raymond, CEO and founder of Profitable Happiness. Dr. Pillay is an educator, musician, best-selling author, and the founder of Profitable Happiness. Through books, software, training, and music, he seeks to change the world by helping organizations build cultures of high employee engagement, experience, and performance. And he was also named after the greatest soccer player ever, Pillay. So welcome. It's good to have you back.
Thank you so much, Dr. John. It is a pleasure to be back with you. We had a lot of fun the first time, but
we did.
This is going to be just the same kind of thing. I love it.
Oh, it'll be a blast. So what, in your opinion, is today's biggest challenge that organizations need to solve around employee and workforce success?
You know, it's interesting. I'm big on AI these days, you know, artificial intelligence. And, I have my account with ChatGPT and I actually went in there and I typed exactly the question that you asked. What is the biggest challenge that organizations are facing today when it comes to their people and things like that? But I added one little additional point to that question. I said that they are willing to pay for. Ooh, because when people put their hands in their pockets, you know it's a real issue, right?
Yeah.
It's not just a nice to have. They're willing to pay to have these things solved. And the number one thing on Bard, on ChatGPT, those are the two I tried, Google's and the OpenAI approach. Number one thing for both of them was employee engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Employee engagement. And, you know, and then of course there's the retention thing. You don't want to lose your employees. There are issues around that too, which is usually number two, but engagement is so important and such a challenge with organizations because you may have heard or your audience may have heard of, this idea of quiet quitting where people are in organizations sometimes just to get that paycheck and quietly walk out the door and they have no emotional connection, no engagement with the company's mission or anything. They're just trying to get by and get things moving, you know? And no company wants that. Every company wants the highest engaged employees because engagement leads to innovation, creativity, performance. And so that is the number one challenge. And the reason it's a big challenge too is that people haven't solved the problem in 30 years. And I'll tell you more about that going on. It's just an ongoing problem.
So thank you for the explanation. I think, you know, the Gallup organization would definitely agree with you because they've done research over the past, 30 plus years looking at employee engagement. And the numbers typically are about 25% of the workforce is actively engaged. 50% is moderately engaged to disengaged, and 25% is actively disengaged. In other words, they're stealing, they're sabotaging projects. And that quiet quitting idea is interesting because I think that also speaks to effort. And the quiet quitting idea, as I understand it, is largely around, I'm going to go to work, I'm going to put in minimal effort, just enough not to get fired. So you're getting like maybe 50 to 60% effort out of your employees. Whereas, that active engagement, the internal motivation is massive because you do get greater creativity, greater innovation. You get effort going above and beyond what you could hope for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how much do you think that comes down to culture and or direct supervisor? Because I know both those have a big influence on engagement.
Yeah, direct supervisor is huge. It's in fact, in almost every survey, you'll find that employees will say things like, well, I quit because of my boss.
Uh-huh. You know, that's the main reason people leave.
Yeah, direct supervision is just so important. And then, as you mentioned, culture is important. You know, when you think about the definition of culture, people need to really look at that. You know, culture is the shared beliefs, behaviors, habits of a group of people. So when you and I kind of believe the same things, work on the same things, and develop habits around it, that's our culture. So you can imagine that if our culture is one of, let's just get by because the boss doesn't trust us, we don't trust her, let's just get this thing done and go home.
If that's how we are,
then that's what's going to happen.
Do me a favor, Dr. Pillay, like give me a few examples of different cultures and kind of the spectrum, because I think culture to me is something that's vague and airy. And I think it always helps me in my, simple mind to make these things more concrete.
Well, I would not call your mind simple, my friend, Dr. John.
I'm just teasing.
Let's make it concrete. I think you're making a very good point. So let's assume that Dr. Pillay and Dr. John, they work for a company, and this company is led by Dr. Susan. And Dr. Susan, the minute you do your job, Dr. Susan will criticize you, tell you the worst parts of what you've done, and send you right back to go get it done, give you no credit for anything good whatsoever. And she does that, but she pays you a lot of money. She gives you, three or multiple six-figure salary just to kind of show up here. So you know what? Dr. John is going to say to Dr. Pillay, don't even worry about it. She's just going to be that way. Let's just get the minimum done, send it home, and let's go do something else that we really like to do at home.
Yeah.
That's a culture of disengagement that's been created, unfortunately, by Dr. Susan or the leader, Susan. And what leaders don't understand is that everything they say, every word, every action in an organization contributes to what we ultimately see as culture. You can either have a positive culture that's pushing you toward high performance, or you can have a destructive and negative culture that's toxic and making everybody want to run out. Thank God it's Friday.
Yeah. Well, and one of the leadership styles which I've wrestled with and which I am not a fan of is this command and control style, which relies on perhaps a paramilitary hierarchy, do as you're said, do as you're told, and really often relies on fear and intimidation and anger.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It sounds like that's kind of part and parcel of
that is part of the
mentioned.
That is part of the problem. And that sets up a culture. Yes. And it sets up an us versus them culture. Whereas the truth is this, employees see their employment as a relationship. Mm-hmm. They don't, a leader might want business results and that's all good, but their employees see coming to work every day as a relationship. They're investing in a relationship. And if they're going to invest their 9-10 hours a day for you, maybe you could give them some love and respect back mm-hmm. and allow them to feel happy in their work. That's the key. So when you view a relationship as the core sort of descriptor of what we're trying to do, it changes everything. Because if I care about you, I'm not going to treat you with disrespect. I'm not going to allow you to feel disengaged. I'm going to work with you.
Wait, so you're saying that if I'm a leader of a company that I need to have some self-awareness and I need to treat my employees with kindness and respect? Pillay, that's so radical. Like, I don't even know. Like, isn't that hippy dippy shit? That I've had a CEO actually told me that one time. And I was like, you're fired.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. It is all about relationships. It is about valuing other humans. It is about lifting other people up. It is about sharing the credit. I mean, there's a bunch of things that we can do to create a better, more engaging culture. So backing up a step, how did you reach this point in your own story of focusing on employee engagement? Because you came from worlds away, from a war-torn village in Africa where survival was probably your primary goal or objective.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that sort of context that you've shared. I have had quite the journey.
It's an amazing journey.
Thank you. You know, I'm glad to be here. but let me just say this. A lot of people address engagement in different ways. Employee engagement is a huge umbrella, and there are many aspects to it. There are things like, you know, how appreciated does a person feel from their manager? How much recognition is happening in the organization? How much participation is happening with employees? There's just so many ways to go about thinking about engagement. But my specific way of getting into the engagement challenge is from a very simple word, and that word is happiness. You know, you might ask, well, why happiness? Well, let's really get honest here. It's a word that's highly misunderstood because a lot of people think happiness is just, hey, I feel good today. Or, you know, we have a ping pong table in the foyer, so we're happy. No, actually, that's called hedonic happiness.
Yeah.
The real kind of happiness that produces engagement is called eudaimonic happiness. And that kind of happiness focuses people on things like flow and engagement and other things that
meaning,
yeah. All those things that produce real work, real outcomes. And so my focus getting into the engagement challenge and solving it is from the concept of eudaimonic happiness, which goes all the way back to Aristotle, by the way.
I was like, you're getting all Aristotle on us.
Yeah, I know. But I renamed it to profitable happiness, because, you know, I don't know that people really want to sit around and say eudaimonic. It's kind of a weird word.
It's a funky word. Yeah.
Yeah. But to answer your question about why and why happiness and why profitable happiness, I would go back to many years ago in the Biafran War in Nigeria. There was a civil war between Nigeria and a people named Biafra, the Igbos. And I was one of those Igbos. And I was a little child.
Different tribes? Is that the right?
Nigeria was the parent country, okay. Right? And Igbos were one tribe out of many, okay? And they were fighting to secede, right?
Okay, gotcha.
Now, the key thing is that war killed millions of people. In fact, it was one of the first and biggest African civil wars, even before Rwanda and all the stuff that we're hearing about more recently. If you remember pictures of black and white pictures with children with the big stomachs and the kwashiorkor and flies buzzing around, people dying everywhere, that was one of those children.
Yeah.
Okay. And we were going from refugee camp to refugee camp, barely surviving. And my mother, in the absence of food or shelter, did the most amazing thing. She would sing to me. She would sing songs. She would take my name, Pele, and put it into a song, Pelelele, Aragansi, whatever. And that would make me happy. And in that space, that happiness would drive away my fear of dying from bombs. It would temporarily even drive away my hunger. And that's when I learned my life's first lesson, that happiness actually comes before success. It precedes success. Forget about Maslow's hierarchy and all those things where you have to first be successful, make money and have your big stuff and then you become happy. No. It's actually the other way around. Right. You can choose happiness and drive success from happiness. And by the way, there was a
meta-analysis some years ago that proved that point. And it's really hard to prove causality in the social sciences, but this meta-analysis proved that happiness precedes success, not the other way around. And I think we're all conditioned to believe, first I'm successful, first I make money, then I retire at 65, and then I'll be happy. And it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't.
It can. I mean, there's exceptions, but in general.
With your 65-year-old analogy, arthritis will show you that it doesn't work that way because you will regret when you were 30 and could have been just as happy, but you chose not to be because you were waiting till you got to be 65. So that's what, for me, is first and foremost in all these ways of looking at employee engagement. My view is, how satisfied are people with what they do? How happy are they with your company's vision, with the leadership around them? And so happiness is a powerful umbrella, eudaimonic happiness, not the frivolous type of happiness, okay? I'm talking about the engagement kind of happiness.
That hedonism, you know, pure pleasure, sex, drugs, rock and roll, that's a part of happiness, but the problem with it is it only lasts as long as the pleasure lasts. So if you're having sex, you know, you're happy, you have these positive emotions, but it only lasts, 30 seconds or so. Maybe that's just me. I don't know.
But, that's got to be just you.
So why profitable happiness? Like, what does this mean in concrete terms? Is it like, you know, to the extent to which my values overlap onto the corporate values? Like, what goes into that?
Okay, so profitable happiness can be viewed on two levels. At the individual level, it's a simple point of, we all have this problem of, how can I be happy in my life and profitable at the same time? It almost seems like getting both of those things to balance together is reserved for someone else out there who's famous or something like that. But the truth is, we can all have profitable happiness, but that's an individual view of it. The view that I am currently focused on is the organizational view of profitable happiness. And that asks the question, how can organizations create profitable businesses while having happy employees? And do the two have to be mutually exclusive? I mean, you have so many, unfortunately, so many leaders who are so focused on the outcome of their organizations, and not as strongly focused on the who or the people that create mm-hmm. the what, right? So it's like, give me the sales results. Give me the marketing results. I want to know what the product is selling for and blah, blah, blah. But when you start talking about how happy are your employees, they go, huh? Who has time for that?
Right.
So that's the real issue, is profitable happiness is about having both a profitable outcomes that are driven by happy employees. That's the organizational context of profitable happiness.
And so what are some of the tools that go into this? I mean, for instance, values and meaning come to the forefront of my mind immediately. And, you know, one of the things I've talked, so I've had three experts on meaning on this podcast in the last few years, like world experts. And I've asked every one of them, because I've thought about this a lot, like, what is the best meaning to pursue? What are the best values to pursue if you want a happy and fulfilling life? The only thing I can come up with to answer that is serve others. Mm. And there's different ways you can divvy up serving others, right? But to me, there's got to be that self-transcendent element to it. Because if it's all about you, if it's all about your wealth, your fame, your power, your pleasure, that's going to get old really fast and it's going to lack meaning.
Dr. John, I have to tell you, that is so spot on that you must be, did you get a PhD in something around this stuff? Cause
I just learned along the way.
Yeah. You're just like, that's it. Actually, let me give you a little story that I love to use to explain what you've just, described. Imagine this, some school kids in a classroom, and their teacher wanted to teach them the lesson that you've just shared. So she brought a whole bunch of balloons and she asked everyone to write their name on the balloon. Okay. And then she said, okay, everybody's written names. So you got, you know, 50 kids or something. All the names are on the balloons. And she goes, okay, now we're going to go outside into the hallway and we're going to spread these balloons all over the hallway. And it's just going to be everywhere. And once they had done that, then she said, okay, everyone, I want you to go back out into the hallway and find your balloon. You can imagine that was a mess, right? Everybody's rushing around. Can't see my balloon. Where is it? This is flown away. Nobody found their balloon. And then she said, okay, we're going to do this example a different way. I want you guys to go back out there and find any balloon. Just grab the first one you see, look at the name on it, and bring it and give it to the person whose balloon it is. Boom, that exercise was done in about 10 minutes. Everybody grabbed one balloon, came inside, found the owner, and gave it to them. And she said, let me tell you what you've just done. You've just learned the lesson of happiness. You find it when you find it for others.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a metaphor and an approach that is proven in business. If you are aware of Zoom, which we're using right now to record this podcast, the Zoom CEO, Eric Yuan, came from China, Japan, two different places, but he came from Asia. I don't want to mix up my history here. He came from Asia, and his only mission in life was to be happy by helping his employees be happy, right? And by creating that culture of, I'm only happy if my employees are happy, he transferred that to them so that they understood that they are only happy when their customers are happy. And so he now had this sort of, you know, ongoing roller coaster of happiness, everybody trying to make the other camp happy, and that's how they become happy. So absolutely, the magic of happiness comes from helping other people be happy.
So what would you say about the concept of altruism? Or can we be truly altruistic?
Yes, I'm sure. It's not my current focus.
Yeah.
And for good reason. I'm obviously at a certain stage in my career. I haven't reached the Bill Gates level yet where I can think that way. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't be altruistic when you're not very financially successful. I'm just saying I'm focused on helping companies that want to build profitability
right. Do
so by helping their employees behave a certain way at work.
I was thinking about it more philosophically that
okay.
Can we as humans truly be altruistic if we receive a positive emotion back in return for helping someone?
Okay. In that context, absolutely. In fact, I think, isn't it true that one of the ways to be most happy is by giving, right? Mm-hmm. Someone did some MRI studies and they measured and found out that you're just as happy, if not more, when you give something away versus when you receive something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the data or the research on right. but I've heard of that. Yeah. So absolutely in that context, yes. But altruism, I was thinking of, you know, philanthropy and, you know, world hunger. And it's like, I'm not thinking that way yet.
Well, altruism doesn't have to be money. I mean, obviously it can be time. It can be you know, little gifts or whatever, but people get hung up on these semantics a lot. To which my reply is, I don't give a shit. Like, I don't care about the debate. Like, go ahead and do something nice for someone regardless. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So what are some of the concrete steps, or how do you approach going into a company and creating a profitably happy culture?
Mm. Three steps. The very first one is to set a mission for profitable happiness. Set a happiness culture mission. So that comes from the leadership. The leadership has to decide that employee well-being is paramount in their organization. You know, I have to tell you another little story. You've probably heard of the fable of the goose and the golden eggs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you got this farmer, this unfortunate farmer, who wanted these golden eggs so much that he took a look at, how can I get some more of these things? And there was the goose. And he goes, okay, let's kill that thing, open it up and get all of the golden eggs in there. And after he killed the goose, he was like, uh-oh, no more eggs, no more goose, no more eggs. And I use that to just, I think, paint the picture of what I think is the number one problem that organizations have, which is, unfortunately, they are structured around shareholder, business benefit, bottom line results, the golden eggs, and not enough firepower and support is going into looking at the goose and the employees that produce those golden eggs. So that's the first thing, right?
Can I ask a question there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think that has to do with time perspective? In other words, I sometimes think about the time perspectives that US corporations have versus some Japanese corporations. Whereas, you know, our timeline might be 5 years, theirs is 100.
Mm.
And so it's much more, I think they think about sustainability and the longer term, which would necessarily, I would think, involve more employee wellness as well.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure how you know, different lenses of sustainability and you know, business success would affect this issue. But I am sure, 100% sure, that if the engine of the success you seek is not taken care of, it'll die,
mm-hmm.
or it'll quit, however you want to describe that. And so that has to be step number one, is to make a decision company-wide that we are here to encourage the well-being and the happiness of employees. That's what I call the first of the three steps, happiness. The second step is called habits. Now, you might say, well, why habits? Before I explain that, let me tell you the third step. The third step is high performance, the outcome. So basically, you know, habits plus or times happiness will give you high performance. So why habits? Well, I think that habits are probably the last pure magic on the planet. You know, people are out there looking for Mars and the moon. I say, look inside your mind. Mm-hmm. Because the mystery and the power of your mind is just like untouched, unbelievable. And because, I mean, look, can you imagine the magic that happens when a six-year-old child is struggling to ride a bike? I remember teaching all my children, all three of my kids, I taught them how to ride their bikes at 6 years old. I took it upon myself. And the same thing happened three times. So it was my little research project. They would struggle for days and weeks and just not be able to get the hang of this simple thing, I thought, of just sit there and just like balance and do this thing. And they would try and try and try until one day, each of them, out of the blue, no explanation, it went from, I can't do it, to boom, they're off. And now they're riding a bike. What happened? What happened in that split second? Well, science teaches us and MRIs show us that what happened is that the data set, the energy of that thing they were trying to learn went from the conscious mind into the subconscious mind. And in that split second, that's what we call muscle memory. They got it under their fingers, or if you will. And all of a sudden, it was now automatic. It was now a habit. And there's this thing called the basal ganglia, right? Which is a part of the brain, part of the subconscious part of the brain. And once you get information persisted in the basal ganglia, you will be able to recall it, remember it, and utilize that information without any thought or any stress whatsoever. So when you apply the power of habits to engagement and happiness and these softer skills, because by the way, the mind does not differentiate between a skill, like, you know, or a feeling. It just, mm-hmm. it will take whatever that concept is. It'll bottle it up, squeeze it up real nice, and be able to just recall it whenever it needs to. So when you are able to build habits around happiness and engagement, and by the way, the reason you can build habits around happiness is because they are actions. A lot of people think that these are just magical things that I'm going to feel someday. No, habits are actions. Happiness is an action. These are choices you can make. Engagement is an action. In fact, I'll give you an experiment. If you smile, if you just go, just smile for a while, you'll start to feel some endorphins and some chemicals going through your body. You cannot both feel good and feel bad at the same time, right? The mind will make a choice. And so when you make the choice that you're going to feel good and you're going to take actions that make you feel good, your body and your emotions and everything else will follow. So building habits is how you take happiness and engagement and all these softer feelings and transform them into the actions that produce high performance. Three steps.
Yeah, and if I can jump in there, I absolutely agree with you on the importance of habits. And I think that the vast majority of us go through life largely as automatons. Mindlessly, we're relying on habits that don't serve us to a large extent.
Yeah.
Smoking cigarettes, shopping when depressed, watching Netflix at the end of a long day.
Hey, wait a second. I like Netflix.
I like Netflix too, but you know, it's not necessarily the best thing you can do for yourself.
I hear you.
So, you know, and so I think that power of moving concepts, skills, feelings from the conscious mind to the subconscious mind is extremely powerful. And you and I are both doing the same thing, trying to get clients or corporations to practice these new skills long enough so that they get burned into that unconscious or subconscious mind. So things like, you know, you're talking about happiness, like forgiveness as a daily practice. You do it long enough, you become a more forgiving person. Gratitude, you do it long enough, you train your mind to focus more on what you have rather than what you don't have. Self-compassion. Absolutely. I mean, all these tools, I think the goal of all of them, meditation, you know, you want to get it so it's a habit, or exercise, so that it's, okay, it's weekday morning at 6 a.m., I go to the gym. I don't even have to think about it.
Yep.
And that's where you're trying to get, I would argue, because then you're using the power of habit to your benefit. You've mindfully thought of, what are the habits I want to include in my life?
Yeah.
And then you've got a whole stable of positive, self-affirming, self-supporting behaviors.
And when we share behaviors and share habits and share beliefs, that's a culture. So why not nurture the right behaviors that we want, get them to become automatic and have all of us just want to do these things, that's how you build a culture. You don't build a culture by demanding it. You don't build a culture by dictating that this is what it is. You build a culture by actually encouraging people to do things repeatedly enough and with connection and engagement to the point where it becomes natural for them.
Yeah, and one of the cultural beliefs, which I've always loved, it comes from Facebook, now Meta. And you know, whatever you think about the company, because there's a lot of different ways to interpret the company's behaviors. But one of the values, which I've always admired, is assume positive intent. So, you know, for them, it's assume positive intent with other employees and with customers. But you can also use that in your personal relationships, because I think in romantic relationships, after you've been going out with someone for a long time, you know, there's an accumulation of hurts, resentments, angers, annoyances, and that optimistic lens, which you used to have when you first started dating, slowly, gradually becomes quite negative and pessimistic. And so it's a really good practice to remind yourself to focus on assuming positive intent once again.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, again, words do matter. And so when you bring, you know, assume positive intent into the sort of value system of an organization, and everybody sort of focuses on those words. And if you can, and I'll share with you how I do it, if you can take a specific system that actually encourages repetitive focus on that thing, you then grow the idea of API, maybe that's what they call it, you know, assume positive intent, into a thing, and it becomes a habit. It's the same way that profitable happiness is built. It's by, you know, grabbing some concepts, putting them into an engine. For me, it's software. I have a software tool called Profitable Happiness that does this, which follows the concepts in this book. But that's how you get people to focus on the things you want for them to grow, for them to feed on.
And I agree, repetition is key.
Yeah.
And so do you start with one, I don't know, skill or tool, and then, you know, repeat, repeat, repeat? And, you know, there's also a debate over how long it takes to acquire a new habit. And what I found out is there's no actual real good research proving any, like, it's 3 months or it's 1 month or 4 weeks or whatever it is. But I do like the theory that to acquire a new habit, well, that we lose 1% of the cells every day in our body, they die and regenerate. And so after 30 days, your 30% of your body is renewed. After 100 days, 100% renewed. And perhaps habits are at a cellular level of memory, and it takes about 100 days to create a new habit. But I have no science to back that up. That's just a hypothesis.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a musician, and I'm an avid musician, to just tell you that right now. In fact, in my book, you know, I have 12 chapters and 12 songs that accompany each chapter and released onto Apple Music, Spotify, and all of these things is the Profitable Happiness soundtrack. That accompanies the Profitable Happiness book, which accompanies Profitable Happiness software. You get how this is working?
Okay. I see the branding here.
You see the branding here, forcing that into the world, right? No, but I bring that up because repetition is the mother of habit invention, right? Repetition is how the conscious mind gets enough input that it finally surrenders that data point to the subconscious mind. Let me show you something. See this here? I got this model made. This is a model that I use to explain how habits are created, right? And basically, if you look at this, and please don't think it's a human being. These are not hairs.
Okay.
think of these as five inputs. You know, your sensory inputs that go into the brain. They first go into the conscious mind. So you hear things, you see things, you smell things, whatever. That information goes in here. If you give that information, if you give it enough density by repeating and repeating and repeating, at some point, it surrenders that information lower. So if I'm playing a guitar riff, you see my guitar back there, over and over, like a mindless fool. If I'm doing that over and over, my caveman will finally take it. Yeah, yeah. My caveman will finally let go of it and put it into my smarter brain, my tougher brain, my bigger brain, which is down here. And once it gets persisted into the basal ganglia, you have a habit. Mm. And hopefully it's a good habit, because the brain doesn't care if it's a good, bad, doesn't care. The brain is actually, it's funny how smart it is and yet how dumb it can be, because you can fool your brain as well as use your brain to do unbelievable things. So put the right things in here is what I'm trying to say. Don't build the wrong habits. But yeah, this is, it's a magic that we still have.
Well, I like that idea that the brain is a great slave, not a great master. Or thinking exactly. is a great slave, not a great master. So you need that meta, the ability to go meta on your own mind, to think about thinking, metacognition. Mm-hmm. It also makes me think of, you know, how important self-awareness is in this whole process. Because, you know, I'm a big fan of Tasha Yurick's work that shows that 95% of us will self-report being highly self-aware. Mm-hmm. And in fact, research shows it's about 12 to 15%. And so, and I deal with a lot of male clients, and a lot of them think they're highly self-aware, and yet there's this huge disconnect between what, how they perceive themselves and how others perceive them, particularly their spouse.
Yeah.
And so I could see getting hamstrung a little bit in these efforts where people are like, well, I'm already happy, or I already know how to forgive, or I'm already self-compassionate, or, you know, whatever the tools are that you espouse.
Yeah. You know, and I think that it is safest, and I'm sorry, I'm going to use this plug again, to think of us as cavemen still. Mm-hmm. Because our minds, it's safest to just say, you know, I'm just going to accept that I'm not that self-aware. I'm not that advanced. My mind follows very specific rules that it has followed for eons. Mm-hmm. Okay. Human beings, you know, in the evolution of life. And so when we recognize what those patterns are, we can then use them to our benefit. And I'll give you one example of the pattern that I use in my system of building cultures. It's a well-known pattern in the organizational behavior modification community. In fact, you know, my PhD is in organization and management, so I'm very connected to this community. It's called the ABC approach of building behaviors and building habits. It goes all the way back to Pavlovian dogs and how you get a dog to want to do this, or a rat to want to do that. It's just the same thing. ABC stands for the antecedent, the behavior, and the consequence. Mm-hmm. Now, how does that work? If you want to design any behavior in a caveman or a human being, just recognize what comes before the behavior, what the behavior is, and what comes after the behavior, and manipulate the antecedent, the behavior, and the consequence until you get that behavior done over and mm-hmm. over to become a habit. Now, what I did in my book, because this is really the value that I'm bringing to the world, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, of course, like Pavlov and the ABC theory. I simply extended that, because if you try to do it yourself, you going back to your point about self-awareness, you're going to probably struggle with the fact that your antecedent is boring. and it's like, okay, I have an antecedent. I know what comes before that, going out to work out on my bicycle. But no, what you need to do, and this is what I'm bringing to the table, is you need to make your antecedent exciting. It has to get your attention. It has to be desirable. So instead of antecedent, I call the first step attention. Get your own attention about this thing that you've got to do. So if that means you wake up in the morning and a bell hits you on the head and you go, hey, that hurts. And then it tells you, go and work out. If that's your little trick for yourself, do it, because it gets your attention, whatever that might be. Then the next thing is behavior. Sure. Knowing that I need to do a behavior over and over is okay, but it's not enough, because guess what happens to most of us? Again, we lose a sense of belief and a sense of, we get bored or we just get tired of trying something and not seeing results. So what you need on the second step is the belief that this thing is still worthwhile. Imagine managers in a company that can continue to help employees stay motivated and, you know, continue to spread the belief system of the organization so that they can make the results happen. That's what you need. So,
well, and pardon me, can I jump in there? Because I think as far as belief goes, I think you've got to believe it's worthwhile. You've also got to mm-hmm. believe that you can do it.
Yes. Yes.
Because that's one of the things that I see hamstring many people that I work with, particularly those that have some depressive tendencies. They don't believe it's possible.
Yeah. So we need the belief system to keep us actually doing the behavior. right? And then once you've done the behavior, you need not just a consequence of the behavior, you need to make that consequence a celebration. Because the dopamine and the positive feelings that come from celebration are so much more powerful than negative consequences in terms of motivating us to want to do that thing all over again. So when you have attention, belief, and celebration, you perpetuate a cycle and therefore you build habits and a culture. So that's like my system.
I like the reframe. And you know, the other thing is that, you know, as far as habits go, and some of these habits experts have been talking about breaking down a new habit into very kind of micro habits or micro behaviors, which I like. And the example is, you know, let's say you're trying to start going to the gym. And so you dress in your gym clothes the night before and sleep in your gym clothes. Because all it takes to kick us off any of these new habits is a thought. And so, you know, the thought's going to be, oh, it's cold out there. I don't feel like getting out and changing. Okay, well then sleep in your gym clothes. Oh my gosh, the floor is cold. I don't want to, you know, put my feet on the cold floor. Put your socks and sneakers right next to the bed. And then, you know, you like the first day, you just go to the car, sit in the car 5 minutes, then come back inside. Second day, you get in the car, drive to the parking lot of the gym, sit there 5 minutes, come back home. Third day, go to the gym, go inside for a few minutes, walk around, come back, go home. And, you know, then you go and stretch. And then, and so you're extending, you're creating those neural pathways of it's 6 a.m., I go to the gym. And, you know, I like that metaphor of, you know, kind of creating new neural pathways or new habits is like traversing across a snow-covered field. And the first time you go across it, you're sinking in 3 or 4 feet of snow, and it's a struggle, it's effort, it takes attention. The second time you go across it, there's your footsteps to step in, so it's a little bit easier. Third, fourth, fifth time, that snow gets trampled until there's a clear pathway and it's quite easy.
Absolutely. In fact, another way of looking at the idea of these micro habits, if you will, is to think of the word focus. That's really what they're all doing. They're helping you stay focused, because the key to, you know, perpetuating and deepening the strength of those myelin neural connections, right? Back to your point about neural pathways, the key is to focus. And so my approach to implementing this actually is through software focus. Now you might say, well, how does software help me focus? Do you know, Dr. John, that if I ask you questions, I'm actually making you focus on something. That's why the entire field of psychology is about questions. That's why the sales process in business is about questions. I'll tell you what, if you are in a sales situation and you're asking questions, you, sir, are running that conversation. But if you are in a sales situation and all you're doing is talking, nobody's listening. People listen when they talk. So the point I'm trying to make here is that focus is so important, and you achieve focus by either using the micro habits or in an organizational context by asking employees questions. So when you have what we call a pulse survey that goes out every week and asks very specific questions, what you're doing is you're focusing people very specifically on one thing that over time becomes habit and then becomes a culture.
Yeah, I was going to ask if, you know, how much measurement is a part of your system? Because I think, you know, things that we measure grow, again, by virtue of attention and focus.
Absolutely. I would say there are three sort of aspects of my business, or my software, I think is what you're referring to at this point. One is measurement, right? Because, you know, what we measure becomes habits. That's how I like to say it. You know, I know that there's a saying, what you measure is what you improve. But I would say that what you measure becomes a habit, and a habit is what makes you improve things. Okay. All right. So what you measure becomes a habit. So measurement is what my software is all about. It measures happiness. It measures engagement. It measures appreciation. It measures recognition, pride, all of these intangibles that create employee well-being. It measures all that. The second aspect of what it does is it helps you focus on the desired culture that you're looking for, right? So by asking specific questions, you're building data around how people are responding to what you want them to focus on. And the third thing is advice, right? So for example, you know, when you gather all this data about your employees and their happiness levels, their engagement levels, well, then what, right? So the system is based on AI. It's artificial intelligence that delivers answers in real time, split second, about anything you want surrounding your people data. So for example, let's say after 4 or 5 weeks of receiving these pulse surveys, asking questions that focus us on happiness and these things, we get data that shows us just how happy our employees are. That data, when you ask a simple question, well, what should I do? That data goes to our AI and answers the question, do this or do that, because it knows your people data. Another thing you could ask it is something like, what would Dr. John do? Or what would Dr. Marshall Goldsmith do to improve my employees' well-being based on our data? And you would get the answer. I don't know if you've been trying things like ChatGPT or...
Oh, yeah.
Then you know how powerful this is to just give leaders a chance to not only see the data, because that's step number one, measurement, right? And help people focus on it, but get real-time advice about it. I have a whole software presentation that I share about it. It's so fun to show people the power of AI when it comes to people data in organizations. Yeah,
one of the challenges I gave it, I think this morning, was write about a topic, I forget what the topic was, in a humorous voice.
And it probably did.
And it did a damn good job.
There you go. It's amazing. It is truly today and the future. And in my world, what I've done is basically I'm sure people are going to be doing this. I don't know if I'm the only one, but I certainly consider this an innovation, which is we need to know how the organization, the pulse of the organization in terms of its culture right now. And rather than go pay Marshall Goldsmith $70,000 for 1 hour to tell me what to do, I can ask my AI to take the exact snapshot. I mean, all the elements of what our culture is, feed it into the system, and given how the data in the world is, give me the best advice possible. Then when I need a real consultant to go deeper so we can go back and forth, I'll pay Dr. Marshall Goldsmith his $70,000. Yeah. Or if we have a Stephen Covey who has passed away, who I can never get. He was the best, right? I can simply ask him, tell me what Stephen Covey would say in order to build the successful company I need based on my data. And that's what the software does.
AI is incredible. So let me ask you this. I mean, you are generally excited, but what are you excited about right now besides AI?
Besides AI, I like the fact that you said I'm generally excited. I think that could be one of my issues in life, my challenges. Like, can you be a little bit less excited about it?
No. I would never ask that of you.
I think what I'm most excited about is the fact that I get to wake up every single day, use my music, I love to write. I've written 8 books now, use my writing. And I love to teach, use my teaching to help people. I mean, really actually help people.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've come to feel that I don't know if you could give me millions of dollars and make me feel any happier than I feel today. I really don't know if that's possible. I mean, what else do I need? I'm getting a chance to use my God-given talents to help others. And it feels great when I can do that. So I'm most genuinely excited that after a lot of trial and error, I've been in and out of different organizational situations that didn't work for me.
Good. I thank God. I thought you were going to say prison.
I've done many entrepreneurial things that you are fully aware of.
Yes.
Some didn't work for me. And I finally found my sweet spot. And it happens to just be take who I am and just give it to the world as it is. So that's kind of what I'm excited about.
Yeah. It's a beautiful answer. And I'm thrilled for you because I think, again, it speaks to that value of serving others, like using your God-given gifts to serve others.
Yeah.
So last question, how and where can the audience reach out to you when they want to learn more?
So basically there are 3 places. The very first place is going to be LinkedIn. And I hate to plug that social environment, but let's just face it. If you're going after helping organizations are going to be on LinkedIn, not on TikTok.
Right.
You know, so LinkedIn is where I can be found, and my handle is simply DRPELE, Dr. Pillay. The second of the three places is my speaking website, which is drpillay.com, DRPELE.com. There you can find information about me, possibly coming to teach, do a workshop, or speak at your organization, at an organization, to help people kind of buy into this powerful thing called profitable happiness. And the third thing is profitablehappiness.com. And by the way, you can get my book and my music and the software from my website and so on. But profitablehappiness.com is actually where the software lives. It's where my podcast lives. And that's where you can basically become a trial user of the software. And from there, your organization can decide to actually become a client of Profitable Happiness software.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. It's always great catching up with you, old friend. I enjoy the hell out of it.
Likewise, Dr. John, I think we are brothers from another mother, maybe? Is that how they say
Absolutely.
It?
All right. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. If you like this episode, please be sure to like, rate, review, and share. And if you didn't like it, you don't have to do a damn thing. Thanks so much. That's it for this one. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.